Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading the San Angelo Standard Times newspaper for the week of Sunday, August 21st, 2022. We'll begin with local stories, then move to state articles, and then we'll read a few sports stories. Finally, we have the horticulture column by Allison Watkins to wrap up the show. Football. Legendary FNL coach Gary Gaines had strong San Angelo ties, by Charles Bryce, published August 23rd. When Gary Gaines was inducted into the Angelo State University Hall of Honor in 2019, the legendary football coach was battling Alzheimer's and wasn't able to visit with me. But I had a great chat with his wife, Sharon, that I'll always treasure. I spent more than an hour on the phone with Sharon Gaines 3 years ago. She talked about how her husband was keeping a smile on his face despite fighting a disease that was robbing him of his cognitive abilities. Mrs. Gaines said her husband was passing on encouraging words to other people in the Alzheimer's Center. His days of roaming the sidelines were long over, but Gaines was still able to have an impact on people. I have an email from Sharon Gaines, who ended things with, "Thank you for listening to this old lady ramble. I do that quite often to anybody who will listen." My heart goes out to Mrs. Gaines and the rest of the family after Gary lost his battle with Alzheimer's on Monday at the age of 73. He was living in Lubbock. The former Odessa Permian High School head coach gained notoriety after the best-selling 1990 book, Friday Night Lights, was made into a major motion picture and a popular TV series. H.G. Buzz Bissinger's book chronicled the Panthers' 1988 season that ended in the Class 5A state semifinals with a loss to eventual state champion Dallas Carter. Carter was stripped of the title by the University Interscholastic League in 1990 for using an ineligible player. Gaines went on to lead Permian to the fifth state championship in program history in 1989. He was an assistant for John Wilkins when the Panthers won the 1980 state title. While most people think of Gaines as the former head coach for Mojo, he has deep roots in San Angelo as well. Before embarking on a 38-year coaching career in the high school and college ranks that included stints at Petersburg, Denver City, Amarillo Tascosa, Monahans, Abilene High, San Angelo Central, Texas Tech University, and Abilene Christian University, Gaines was an All-American at ASU. After graduating from Crane High School, Gaines was a wingback for ASU from 1967 to 1970. He played for legendary Rams head coaches Grant Teff, who later went on to Baylor, and Max Bumgardner. Gaines was the Nathans Award winner in his senior season. Recipients were selected for their teamwork and ability, in addition to being a conscientious player and a significant contributor to the team on and off the field. Former ASU running back great Jerry Austin, another Rams Hall of Famer, reflected on his former teammate in a phone interview 3 years ago. "Gary is approximately 2 years older than I am," Austin said. "We started in the backfield in 1969 and 70. He was a good teammate of mine for 2 years there, and we played on some successful teams together under Coach Teff. It was a lot of fun. It was a pleasure playing with him." I wasn't the beat writer for the Central Bobcats when Gaines was the head coach from 1996 to 99, but I got to spend some time with him at the ASU coaching clinic in 2013, and he acted like we were old friends. We had a staff photographer in the room at the time, and I normally wouldn't do this, but I got a photo with Gaines as we talked football. Gaines looked back on his days as a Ram during that special interview 9 years ago. "The first 2 years that we were here, we were pretty poor," he said. "And then Coach Teff came in 1969 from Texas Tech, and business picked up at that point." His most treasured ASU memory was in 1970 when the Rams upset Texas A&I, now Texas A&M Kingsville, 38-21 at San Angelo Stadium when the Javelinas were the number one team in the country. It was a big thrill for us at that time, Gaines said. We beat them pretty bad out here at San Angelo Stadium. That was the Javelinas' only loss of the season in 1970, as they went on to win the NAIA National Championship. In his four-year stint as the Bobcats head coach from 1996 to 99, Central combined to go 14-28. The Bobcats' best seasons during that four-year stretch were in 1997, 4-6, and 1998, 4-7. One game that really stands out during Gaines' tenure was a 48-42 triple overtime decision against Permian in 1997. The Bobcats made the playoffs in Gaines' last two seasons. In 1998, Central lost to Permian 42-20 in a bi-district showdown. Gaines had two stints as Permian's head coach, 1986-89 and 2009-2012. When he returned to San Angelo to coach against the Bobcats in his second go-around at Mojo in 2009, Standard Times writer Paul Harris talked to him about returning to his old stomping grounds. I played a lot of football games in San Angelo, Gaines said. I've got a lot of really good friends here that I keep up with, and I enjoyed the time that I spent there. It'll be fun to return. Gaines wasn't able to recreate his earlier magic at Permian when he took over the Panthers again after a 20-year hiatus, but his legacy was already well established. San Angelo fans will get a chance to pay their respects for Gaines during a moment of silence at Lakeview's season opener against La Mesa at 7 p.m. Friday at San Angelo Stadium. There will also be a moment of silence for Gaines at Central's home opener against El Paso Montwood on Friday, September 2nd. Man arrested for aggravated kidnapping in San Angelo by Rosanna Frere. Published August 18th. A 44-year-old man was arrested and charged with aggravated kidnapping, according to a police news release. On Monday, August 15th, the Tom Green County Sheriff's deputies responded to the 1000 block of Mahon Avenue after receiving a 911 call that came from a woman requesting help. Deputies arrived on scene to find a male subject that was a victim of an assault, according to the release. The male subject advised the person who assaulted him fled the scene with a female, whom he also assaulted and forced into a vehicle. The original male subject was transported to a hospital for treatment. During the subsequent investigation, Jonathan Wayne Staker was identified as the suspect. A possible location for Jonathan Staker was determined to be in Reynolds County, and a contact phone number was located for the female victim, the release stated. With the assistance of the Reynolds County Sheriff's Office, the Tom Green County Sheriff's Office located the suspect vehicle and the female victim, who also sustained non-life-threatening injuries during the incident. On Tuesday, August 16th, the Tom Green County Sheriff's Office obtained a warrant for Staker's arrest. On Wednesday, August 17th, the Tom Green County Sheriff's Office was able to track the whereabouts of Staker and take him into custody without incident. Staker was booked into the Tom Green County Jail for aggravated kidnapping, a first-degree felony, and remains in jail in lieu of a $500,000 bond as of 3:30 p.m. Thursday. Railway Museum of San Angelo to host Dream of Steam play in September, from staff reports. Published August 19th. Raise a toast to the Railway Museum's 25th anniversary with the true tale of how San Angelo got its depot. Step back into history and see Arthur Stillwell's Dream of Steam, September 8th through September 11th at the San Angelo Railway Museum of San Angelo. Arthur Stillwell had a dream, and San Angelo was at the heart of that dream. The railway wheeler dealer heard voices, dreamed big, and imagined a mighty railroad running through San Angelo and into Mexico. His trains would transport the riches of the Orient to the United States and make a fortune for those who had the vision to follow him. Over 100 years ago, Arthur Stillwell built 2,300 miles of railroad, founded 40 cities, and added $1 billion to the U.S. economy. He was a visionary, he was controversial, and he picked San Angelo for the main depot of his dream. Come back to 1910 and meet this historic entrepreneur and learn the rest of the story. You will get a copy of the Kansas City, Mexico, and Orient Railway stock certificate declaring you a stockholder. You'll be transported through time with this original play and meet Pancho Villa, whose words about the Mexican Revolution are based on an extensive research. September 8th is also the opening of the Arthur Stillwell exhibit at the Railway Museum. This first new exhibit in many years was put together by Rocio Monsibais, the new curator for the Mayer Museum at San Angelo State University. Monsibais is the treasurer of the Railway Museum Board of Directors and previously worked for Fort Concho and the San Angelo Symphony. The actors for Arthur Stillwell's Dream of Steam are all local and will be dressed in the styles of 1910. This is the 21st historical production written and directed by Linda Thorson Bond. She won two National Telly Awards for the 2018 PBS production on her play for a museum in Colorado. Her historical novel, Saving the Oldest Town in Texas, was a finalist for the 2019 International Book Awards. Bruce McLaren, who uses his expertise as an ex-librarian, has been instrumental in the research on this incredible true Stillwell story. When the Dream of Steam journey ends, you'll find yourself on the railway platform enjoying champagne and treats in a place straight out of Stillwell's dream. Make reservations now for Arthur Stillwell's Dream of Steam at the Railway Museum of San Angelo, September 8th through the 11th. There are two evening presentations Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and a matinee on Sunday. Tickets are $25 and include champagne and hors d'oeuvres, 1910 style. For tickets, visit sanangelorailway.org or call 325-486-2140. And now we begin state articles with three stories related to Uvalde. Uvalde School Board fires District Chief Pete Arredondo over school shooting response by Nikki Griswold, Luz Moreno Lozano, and Katie Hall, Austin American Statesman, published August 24th. Uvalde. 3 months to the day after the mass shooting at Robb Elementary, the Uvalde School Board Wednesday night fired School District Police Chief Pete Arredondo, who has been the focus of much of the scrutiny and blame for law enforcement's 77-minute delay in confronting the gunman who shot and killed 19 children and two teachers on May 24th. The board adjourned immediately after the unanimous vote and did not discuss it publicly. Arredondo did not attend the meeting. Instead, his attorney released a 17-page statement Wednesday evening, arguing that all of Arredondo's actions on May 24th were consistent with active shooter training and that Chief Arredondo did the right thing. "Any allegation of lack of leadership is wholly misplaced," the statement said. "The complaint that an officer should have rushed the door, believed to be locked, to open it up without a shield capable of stopping an AR-15 bullet without breaching tools is tantamount to suicide." State investigators have found that the door was never locked and there was no evidence that any officer tried opening the door. Hallway video obtained by the American Statesman showed the first of several officers arriving with shields 19 minutes after the gunman. The statement emphasized in bold and italic that Arredondo and other officers in the hallway were not aware that children were inside the classroom. 911 dispatchers fielded calls from children inside the classroom pleading to be rescued, but word of those calls apparently never reached officers on the scene. Days after the shooting, Texas Department of Public Safety Director Steve McGraw identified Arredondo as the incident commander and said he mistakenly treated the situation as a barricaded subject and not an active shooter, which requires immediate action to stop the gunman. Later in testimony before a state Senate panel, McGraw said Arredondo decided to place the lives of officers before the lives of children. In the Wednesday statement, Arredondo's attorney, George E. Hyde, called characterizations of Arredondo as the incident commander patently false. "Out of all the officers that were there, from all sorts of agencies and departments, not even one came to him with the suggestion that he should take a different approach," the statement read. "So it appears self-evident that all the officers that responded are reasonable and the actions he took were reasonable. In total, 376 officers responded to the deadly shooting, including 149 U.S. Border Patrol agents, 91 DPS troopers, and 5 Uvalde School District officers. Turn in your badge. Uvalde residents demand action. County members and friends and family of the slain fourth graders and their teachers packed the John H. Harrell Auditorium on Wednesday, demanding accountability from the school board, who took the item into executive session before taking a final vote in open session. 6 community members spoke, including 10-year-old Caitlin Gonzalez, a friend of Jackie Cesarez, who died in the shooting. If a law enforcement person's job is to protect and serve, why didn't you protect my friends and teachers on May 24th? Gonzalez said. I have messages for Pete Arredondo and all the law enforcement that were there that day. Turn in your badge and step down. You don't deserve to wear one. During the more than hour-long executive session, family members went up to the podium to share tearful stories of their loved ones and demanding change, accountability, and action. The names of each of the victims were read aloud. Remember the names, remember their faces, one community member said. 3 months is too long for justice. The Uvalde community, in particular the families of the victims, have demanded accountability for law enforcement's lack of coordination and inaction in responding to the massacre. A report by the Texas House Investigative Committee found systemic failures and miscalculations among all levels of law enforcement that responded to the scene, including the failure of Arredondo to assume his designated role as incident commander, and the failure of any other larger law enforcement agency to take charge. Senator Roland Gutierrez calls for more accountability. The school board had previously scheduled a vote last month on firing Arredondo, but canceled that meeting at the request of his attorney and in conformity with due process requirements, according to a school district news release at the time. Arredondo was placed on paid administrative leave in June and unpaid administrative leave a month ago. Arredondo won a seat on the city council weeks before the shooting and was sworn in privately after the shooting. He resigned from that post in July after missing multiple meetings. Uvalde residents had previously urged the board to fire all 6 members of the Uvalde School Police Force, as well as Superintendent Hall Harrell and former Robb Elementary Principal Mandy Gutierrez, after the House committee found that school employees left the school vulnerable to an intruder by leaving exterior doors unlocked and not fixing a broken lock on the classroom door where the gunman entered. Gutierrez had been placed on administrative leave and then was reassigned to a new position. Arredondo is the first law enforcement official to lose his job over the flawed response to the shooting. Other law enforcement agencies, including the Uvalde Police Department, have said they are internally reviewing their response to the Uvalde school shooting and will act according to their findings. Acting Uvalde Police Chief Lieutenant Mariano Pargas was put on administrative leave in July. State Senator Roland Gutierrez, a Democrat whose district includes Uvalde, attended the meeting Wednesday and said the board made the right decision to fire Arredondo, but that more accountability is needed. That needed to happen. It needed to happen a long time ago, Gutierrez told the American Statesman. It's important that this community begin a healing process and begin to try and move on. The fact is, there is a lot of accountability that still needs to be had, including the Department of Public Safety. DPS has not released any records related to the shooting, but Gutierrez said he plans to keep pushing for that information. In June, Gutierrez sued DPS, arguing that he is entitled to official records related to the shooting. Over a dozen media outlets, including the American Statesman, earlier this month, also sued the agency to gain access to requested records that detail law enforcement's response to the shooting. The records, which have been requested by numerous outlets under the Texas Public Information Act, are being withheld, citing exemptions tied to ongoing investigations. Uvalde families poised to file $27 billion lawsuit over mass shooting, by Nikki Griswold, Austin American Statesman, published August 24th. Lawyers for 9 families tied to the Robb Elementary shooting said they might sue the Uvalde School District, city officials, and state and federal agencies, alleging negligence and failure to act in the course of the May 24th attack that left 19 children and two teachers dead. A letter from the lawyers said the amount of the claims will total $27 billion. Charles Bonner, a lawyer based in Sausalito, California, and one of several attorneys representing the families, said he served the Uvalde School Board with notice of claim of a class mass action at its Monday night school board meeting, and he served the Uvalde City Council during its regularly scheduled meeting Tuesday evening. Bonner said the family's members, identified in the claim notice only by first name and last initial, did not include any with the students killed or injured in the attack, but were in the zone of danger at the school. Bonner said that families also might sue Daniel Defense, which manufactured the AR-15-style rifle used by the gunman, as well as the Uvalde County Sheriff's Office, the Texas Department of Public Safety, and the U.S. Border Patrol, all of which responded to the mass shooting. Bonner said he will seek $27 billion for the families as compensation for a list of damages, including significant mental and emotional distress, and to provide for a medical monitoring fund for the victims' families so they can access psychological support for the rest of their lives. The claim heavily cites a Texas House Investigative Committee's July 17th report on the shooting that found extensive and systemic failures in the law enforcement response on both the local and state level. Those faulty assumptions and poor decisions resulted in the shooter remaining inside two classrooms with his victims for more than 70 minutes before officers engaged and killed him. The claim effectively serves as a formal notification of the family's intent to file a potential federal class action lawsuit if a settlement isn't reached. Bonner said if negotiations do not lead to a result the families find acceptable by the end of September, he will file the lawsuit in federal court in San Antonio. Bonner said he anticipates several more families will join the suit in the coming days. After the Robb Elementary shooting, some Uvalde parents choose private or online education. By Brian Lopez, published August 17th. Brianna Gonzalez, fresh off her nursing shift, sat quietly alongside her two sons in Uvalde High School's auditorium this past week as school district officials laid out for parents new safety measures for the upcoming school year. Gonzalez has decided to keep her two sons, a kindergartner and a fifth grader, in the district, but it wasn't the easiest decision. Her oldest was at Robb Elementary on May 24th, the day an armed teenager entered the school and killed two teachers and 19 children. Fortunately, she had taken her son home before the shooter entered the building. But a summer of conflicting government narratives has set Uvalde parents on edge, particularly after a state report showed that 376 law enforcement officers showed up at Robb on May 24th, but did not engage the shooter for more than an hour. Parents are now trying to plan for the back-to-school season and facing tough choices over their children's education and safety. Some are keeping their kids in the Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District when the school starts on September 6th. Some are choosing homeschooling, and others are looking at private schools. "I just didn't see what the point of going to another district would do for me," Gonzalez said. "If it could happen here, it could happen there." Gonzalez, like other parents in this working-class community, doesn't have the time or money to look for other options right now. She has a full-time job, and she's usually up earlier to get herself and her kids ready for the day. "Their dad works out of town and is usually home only on the weekends," she said. That rules out trying to get her kids to nearby districts, or pay for private school, or even consider online school. "COVID affected them a lot, and I saw how that affected their education, and I don't want them to have to go virtual again," she said. "I don't have the time of day to do things with them for school, so I feel like I would be failing them on that part of their education." At least in Uvalde, she said, the district is working toward making the school more secure as the first day approaches. In the high school auditorium, Uvalde School Superintendent Hal Harrell laid out for parents and students the district's plans to make schools here secure, as well as offer more access to mental health resources. He discussed the district's partnership with Texas Child Health Access through telemedicine, also known as TCHATT, which helps identify behavioral health needs of children and adolescents. The district is also contracting Rhythm, a company with an app that allows staff and students to log how they are feeling. Communities in Schools, a nonprofit organization focused on connecting students with resources, is also sending teams to the district to provide additional behavioral health support to students. The district is upgrading security on its 7 campuses. Fencing is being installed at some schools, but Harrell couldn't promise that Uvalde High School would be secure with fencing before the first day because of the sheer size and openness of that campus. There will be 33 Texas Department of Public Safety officers deployed across the Uvalde School District throughout the school year. The district is also accepting applications for campus monitors who would check locks on doors and gates and provide reports to the administration. Some 500 cameras will be installed at campuses before the first day of school. The district has spent about $4.5 million so far in security upgrades, with some of the money coming from donations and grants. Uvalde CISD will offer an online option for students who want to stay in the district but not attend in-person classroom instruction. Students who opt for online instruction will receive brand new iPads, Harrell said. The Texas Education Agency is in the process of approving Uvalde's virtual school and making sure it complies with Senate Bill 15, the virtual education bill that passed during last year's second special session. The bill also caps the number of students in the district that can be enrolled in a district's online alternative. The school district will need a waiver from TEA if more than 10% of all enrolled students want to be in the online school. But for Gonzalez, Uvalde's new security plans seem to satisfy her, and her children will return to the district's in-person classes. Uvalde is implementing new security features, having the troopers there. That brings another sense of added security, she said. Gonzalez made the decision 2 weeks ago to send her kids back to Uvalde CISD. It's something that parents here don't usually question in this small town of 15,000, about 85 miles west of San Antonio, she said. As a lifelong Uvalde resident, Gonzalez wanted her children to have the same experience she did attending district schools. She also wants her children to regain a sense of normalcy after 2 years of school disruption from the pandemic. But as a result of the shooting, Gonzalez still has a sense of fear and concern as the first day approaches. She bought her oldest son, who is 10, a cell phone. She hadn't planned to get him a phone until he was 13. She also plans to buy them bulletproof backpacks, which she sees as an investment. Last year, it was just, I have to buy school clothes, and that was it, she said. This year is completely different. Adam Martinez, the father of 2 students, will send his kids to the online school that Uvalde is offering. It wasn't his first choice, but as he spoke with his kids, it was obvious they were still scared. I was telling my son, there's going to be a tall fence. They're going to have state troopers on all the locations, Martinez said. And he told me, who cares if there's cops? They're not going to do anything anyway. They're scared. Others, though, still have not regained the trust of the school district. Angelie Gomez, a parent who has had 2 children at Robb the day of the shooting, was handcuffed that day trying to get answers from law enforcement about her children. Now she and 19 other women have been in touch with a woman in San Marcos who has offered to homeschool their children for free. Uvalde's mayor has said Robb Elementary will be demolished and another school will be built in its place. But until that happens, no student will have to return to the school. Instead, students will be spread out to different Uvalde CISD campuses. One of those is Flores Elementary. Gomez doesn't think it's a good idea to transfer the children from Robb there. They're trying to stuff our kids, 3rd, 4th, 5th, and 6th grade, in Flores, since they want to demolish Robb. But Flores won't fit our kids, she said. We're going to have, 33 kids in a class? They're not going to pay attention or learn. Jeremy Newman, deputy director of the Texas Homeschool Coalition, advised that parents consider withdrawing their kids from the public school system in favor of homeschooling don't need to recreate what a public school does. People feel like they have to be a master in all academic subjects, Newman said. The parent's job is not as much to transfer knowledge from their head to the student's head as it is for them to provide a learning environment where the students want to learn. For people who haven't been in charge of homeschooling their child, it can be an overwhelming task to find the right resources for their child. Newman suggests they contact his group, which helps families who have always homeschooled or those who are just starting out. The number of families homeschooling at least one child has tripled in Texas since the start of the pandemic, Newman said. According to the Texas Education Agency data, nearly 30,000 students between grades 7 through 12 withdrew from Texas public schools to homeschool in the 2020-21 school semester, a 40% increase over the prior year. Topping the reasons people are choosing homeschooling are safety and academics, he said. Still, other Uvalde parents will send their children to Sacred Heart Catholic School, one of three private schools in the city. Principal Joseph Olan said interest in his school has increased from previous years. During the last school year, he had about 55 students enrolled. This year, that number has ballooned to 120, and he expects it to grow as the school year goes on. The school has received donations to put up a fence around the campus, bulletproof the windows and door, and install a new security camera system. There are primary reasons why families are coming, Olin said. It's not clear how many students Uvalde CISD will be losing this next school year. In Texas, schools are funded on the number of students enrolled and the daily attendance on campus. Schools receive a base allotment of $6,160 per student each year. Any dip in enrollment means less money for the school district. Diana Olvedo Caru, who works in the school district's transportation department, said homeschooling in Uvalde has not been common, but more people are talking about it now. Olvedo Caru is concerned over the funding the district will lose if children are pulled out, but she understands why parents might do it. Uvalde school officials did not immediately respond to the Texas Tribune's request for enrollment numbers for this upcoming school year. Uvalde parent Tina Quintanilla, 41, plans to use a private online school company, K-12, for her daughter's instruction this next year. She also has a son who requires special education classes, and she still hasn't found a school for him. Quintanilla is a graduate of Uvalde High School, home of the Fighting Coyotes and Lobos, so the decision to look at alternatives wasn't easy. It's heart-wrenching because we're coyote pride here, she said, referring to the high school's mascot. We're loyal and true. Reporter Ariana Perez Castells contributed to this story. And now, on a different subject, here's another article. This one from the Austin American Statesman and published in the San Angelo Standard Times August 19th. Another Texas freeze likely this winter? Here are the Farmer's Almanac Winter Predictions by Heather Osborne. As Central Texas continues to weather record-setting heat and some of the worst drought conditions seen in more than a decade, the Farmer's Almanac is painting a white picture for the winter. The periodical, founded in 1818, with a focus on long-range weather forecasting, is predicting significant snowfall January 12th through the 15th in Central Texas. That snowfall would follow heavy snow the magazine expects in northern Texas, January 4th through the 7th, with frosty conditions forecast for the Gulf Coast. My feeling is it's going to be a chilly winter, Peter Geiger, editor of the Farmer's Almanac, said while explaining over the phone from Maine that the magazine does not have a concrete definition of what classifies as chilly. In my mind, chilly is colder than normal. I know you've been so unbearably hot down there that one can only dream of January. But not everyone is convinced. Keith White, a National Weather Service meteorologist for the Austin-San Antonio region, said the Farmer's Almanac predictions are more like a coin flip. And after reading over the publication's extended forecast for this winter, he said he's not very confident in its predictions. There is little to no scientific evidence that sunspot activity and the position of planets have any impact on our weather and our climate, White said. A lot of the statements they use in terms of what they expect over the course of a season are very broad and can be applied kind of subjectively by people. The Farmer's Almanac develops its extended forecast using a 204-year-old mathematical formula focused around sunspot activity, planet positions, and tidal actions of the moon. David Young, an astronomer and mathematician who was the first editor of the Farmer's Almanac, created the mathematical formula 2 centuries ago. Since then, only 7 people have been hired by the periodical to use the formula, altered slightly over time, to come up with weather predictions, according to Geiger. Those predictions are calculated 2 years in advance, he explained. Though weather forecasting and long-range forecasting in particular remains an inexact science, many longtime almanac followers maintain that our forecasts are 80 to 85% accurate, the almanac's website says. White explained that while the Farmer's Almanac might be a preferred source for many in Texas, he recommends the National Weather Service's Climate Prediction Center when looking ahead for predictions. Still, the Farmer's Almanac, though the dates might not have been exactly on par, claims it did land on the right side of White's coin flip by accurately predicting the 2021 winter storms that overwhelmed the Texas power grid, leaving many without power in sub-freezing temperatures and resulting in more than 200 deaths. State health officials determined that 246 people in Texas, 28 of them in Travis County, died as a result of the winter storm, although experts estimate the true number of victims is likely much higher. Geiger explained that while his predictions find that Central Texas will likely experience a few cold snaps this winter, the Farmer's Almanac is not forecasting the kind of severe weather experienced during the deadly February 2021 storms. Finding common ground, both Geiger and White agree that Central Texas likely will not experience storms this winter as severe as those in 2021. This year, we expect a high likelihood of our third straight fall into winter of La Nina conditions, a climate pattern that typically leads to warmer and drier weather, White said. I know a lot of people both last winter and coming into this winter are certainly still worried that they may see conditions similar to what we had back in February of 2021. But honestly, that week of winter weather was a once every few decades kind of probability. And now sports. Former San Angelo Central guard Ruiz to play hoops for University of the Southwest by Charles Bryce, published August 11th. Another San Angelo Central High School boys basketball player is taking his game to the University of the Southwest in Hobbs, New Mexico. Former Bobcat guard Dominic Ruiz made his plans official earlier this week to play for the private NAIA Christian school that competes in the Red River Athletic Conference. What made me want to go there was to continue playing basketball and just doing what I love, as well as continuing my academic career and furthering myself into becoming a physical therapist, Ruiz said. If God allows me to continue to keep going further with basketball, I'll keep doing that. I'll just keep working hard in everything I do, and I'm blessed to do that with this offer. I'm glad I can do it. Not many people can say they can. Ruiz will be teammates with his former teammate, Matthew Cooper, who signed an agreement with the University of the Southwest in April. The 5'10" guard talked about what he has to offer a college team. I bring a lot of hard work, good shooting, and a great team player, Ruiz said. I love to move the ball. I'm unselfish with it. I score when needed, and I pass when needed as well. Central finished 21-11 overall and 7-5 in district this past season to earn the number 4 playoff seed under head coach C.J. Villegas. The Bobcats got knocked out by El Paso Americas in the first round of the playoffs for the second straight year. Ruiz said it was an ideal situation playing for the Bobcats. Oh man, it was fun, especially playing for Coach V and former assistant Jamal Anane, Ruiz said. They made it great. They actually made it amazing. They taught me a lot of life's lessons, as well as things on the court. They taught me how to push into different gears and to keep working, and told me a lot of stuff that will be with me for the rest of my life. Those two coaches taught me a lot of stuff that I know, and I'm grateful for them. I was blessed to be able to be with them this year and the previous year. Ruiz and his teammates were inseparable. Like our coaches said a lot, this group was really special because of how close we were on and off the court, Ruiz said. It was a whole bunch of chemistry involved and a lot of hanging out outside of basketball at school. And I feel like this group was more like a family than anything. We pretty much considered ourselves as brothers. It helped us with our chemistry. We trusted each other more than I feel like anybody could ever say they could. Robert Lee Steers began new era under head coach Lee McCown by Paul Harris, published August 17th. Lee McCown has walked the hallways at Robert Lee High School as a student and a principal. Now he'll stand on the sidelines as the new head coach of the Steers football team. McCown, a standout athlete at Robert Lee, who helped lead the boys' basketball team to the state tournament his senior year in 1995, inherits a football program that has struggled in recent years, including a 2-8 record last year and an 0-4 mark in district. McCown hopes to lead a turnaround. I want to be competitive, and our team wants to be competitive throughout the year and gain a little bit of respect, said McCown, who coached for 17 years before spending the last 5 years in administration. McCown said senior lineman Ryan Mendoza and junior running back defensive back Braden Sherwood are two of the team's top returners that should lead the way. I'm expecting big things out of both of them, McCown said. Sophomore running back linebacker Jose Heredia is also back after seeing playing time as a freshman. Another returning letterman is junior Brody Pitcock, who will take over as quarterback. McCown says he has a lot of sophomores looking to contribute, including Anthony Landeros, Denver Odell, and Jackson Tavares. Robert Lee has spent the last 2 years with 2020 state champ Sterling City and 2021 state champ Westbrook in its district, so realignment was bound to bring a better draw. The Steers now occupy a district with number 10 ranked Erie County, but none of the other teams, Eden, Menard, and Very Best, made the playoffs last season, so a playoff spot could be up for grabs. Robert Lee no longer shares a district with longtime rival Bront, but the two Coke County schools will play September 30th in Robert Lee in their non-district finale. The Steers will open their season at home Friday, August 26th against Rotan. Number 5 Garden City Bearcats ready to tackle state's toughest district by Paul Harris, published August 17th. The Garden City football team seems to have all the pieces in place to make a deep playoff run in 2022 if the Bearcats can survive their district. Garden City enters the season ranked number 5 in the state in Class 1A Division 1, but the Bearcats share a district with number 6 Rankin and number 8 Borden County, and there are only 2 playoff spots to go around. So while expectations are obviously high for all 3 top 10 teams, a heartbreaking ending is waiting for one of them. It's going to be a playoff-type atmosphere every week in this district, Garden City head coach Jeff Jones said. You better show up and be ready to play, and I think our non-district schedule will help us out with that. I feel bad that one of us isn't going to get to the playoffs, because all 3 teams are really good. We just need to make sure we stay focused and take it 1 week at a time and make sure it's not us. Jones likes his team's chances with all of the experience he has coming back from last year's group that had a 7-4 record, highlighted by a 56-44 win over eventual state champion Westbrook. The Bearcats finished as the runner-up to Rankin, however, in district play, and were then upset 70-69 by Van Horn in the first round of the playoffs. Garden City returns all but one starter on each side of the ball, including first-team All-State nose guard Owen Seidenberger, second-team All-State fullback John Lopez, and first-team All-State special teams player Jordan Jones. Mason Walker was an All-West Texas pick at wide receiver, while quarterback Logan Seidenberger and kicker Brock Braden earned All-District honors. In addition to that strong senior class, Jones said junior lineman Alejandro Talamantes is another returner who made a great offseason. Sophomore Denton Rowe is also expected to be a bigger part of the team after contributing last year as a freshman. Jones said the team's returning experience was evident from the moment August practices began. This year, we just hit the ground running. Offensively, we were in about mid-season form the first week of two-a-days, Jones said. It's hard to tell until you start playing some good people, but we'll see some with what our schedule brings. There's plenty of good ones out there, and we'll find out how good we are. Garden City opens the season against number 9 Turkey Valley, and the Bearcat schedule also includes games against number 1 Westbrook and number 3 May, along with a rematch against Van Horn. Garden City will play both of its pivotal district games on the road at Borden County on October 14th and Rankin on November 4th. El Dorado Eagles look to maintain momentum after historic season. By Mike Whitson, special to the Standard Times, published August 17th. Chad Tuttle has seen his fair share of unique mascots throughout his high school football playing and coaching career. He's been an elk, Burleson, a mogul, Monday, a yellowhammer, Rotan, a blizzard, Winters, and a golden tornado, Lamisa, among others. But once he got his chance to be an eagle, the state's most common mascot, he couldn't wait to be the head coach at El Dorado. "I always thought it was a great place, and if I ever got the chance to be here, I would jump on it," said Tuttle, a 17-year coaching veteran entering his first season as a head coach. "When the job came open, it was already middle of summer, and we had just moved. I asked my wife, and she said, 'Go for it.' There really wasn't any hesitation." Tuttle inherits a team that finished 10-2 last season and reached the third round of the playoffs before falling to eventual state finalist Falls City. It was the first time in 71 years El Dorado won a pair of playoff games. The Eagles lost some key talent to graduation, including All-West Texas MVP quarterback Corbin Covarrubias, 3,179 passing yards, 43 touchdowns, 743 rushing yards, 17 touchdowns. All-West Texas running back James Kimball, 1,030 total yards, 13 TDs. And All-West Texas wide receiver Cooper Mador, 908 yards, 20 TDs. However, El Dorado returns 11 starters, 6 on offense and 5 on defense, highlighted by 5 linemen that were all-district, including All-West Texas picks Braxton Elias and Sam Griffin. "You're talking about the heart and soul of your team, is the O-line and the D-line," said Tuttle. "Whether you throw the ball 50 times or you run the ball 50 times, the offense goes as the O-line goes. We've got a great group returning up front." "Defensively, it's the same deal. If your defensive front is pretty good, they make everything behind them look so much better." Tuttle says, along with those returners, some underclassmen are ready to step into key roles as the Eagles pick up where they left off in 2021. "The expectations are the same," he said. "We're not going to back off from the expectations they've set for themselves. This is not the same team from last year. There's new faces and new places, but there are the expectations they have set. That's the new normal. They're going to push and go try to make deep runs in the playoffs." El Dorado will have a different set of district foes this season in 5-2A District 2, joined by Irian, McCamey, and Wink, along with 3 schools, Midland TLCA, Sterling City, and Water Valley, making the jump from 6-man. Paint Rock Indians have renewed playoff hope for 2022 football season, by Paul Harris, published August 19th. The Paint Rock Indians have shared a district with state powers in recent years, so they'll be making no apologies for the UIL realignment, placing them in the worst district in the state the next 2 seasons. That's how Paint Rock head coach Jeff Shelton referred to the outside perception of District 14 1A Division 2, which is comprised of 4 teams that all missed the playoffs last year. Paint Rock, which had a 5-5 record last year, will be joined by Rising Star, 5-4, Panther Creek, 3-6, and Moran, 2-7. "Every team must be thinking the same thing. 2 playoff spots and a district title are there for the taking. At our district meeting, we were laughing about it because most people from the outside are viewing us as the worst district in the state in 6-man, and we know that," Shelton said. "I think Rising Star is going to be the team to beat in our district, but I think our kids can compete." Paint Rock is dropping from Class 1A Division 1, where the Indians were among the schools with the lowest enrollment, so they should be more competitive from a numbers standpoint. Paint Rock also returns 4 starters on both sides of the ball and 11 lettermen overall, though the Indians will have to replace All-West Texas running back linebacker Brandon Belk. he was probably 90% of the offense, so we lost a lot of old on-field production there, Shelton said. Seniors Sal Fuentes and Mason Mears have picked up the slack with their leadership heading into this season, Shelton said. For seniors, when you're changing schemes and coaching styles, sometimes it can be hard to adjust, but they've adjusted well, and they've done a good job leading our kids, Shelton said. Sophomore Jaden Hernandez is projected to take over as the spread back on offense, while junior Brian Herridge will be running back. Junior Eric Jefferson, who Shelton called probably our strongest pound-for-pound guy in our program, could be used as a playmaker around the formation or on the line. Senior lineman Landon Calhoun is also expected to play an important part on both sides of the ball, Shelton said. Paint Rock will open its season Friday, August 26th at Lawn. The Indians' home opener will be September 2nd against Medina. The only ranked team on the Indians' schedule is number 15 Rochelle, which will visit Paint Rock on September 9th. I've learned over 20 years of coaching that injuries can be a factor, grades can be a factor, luck can be a factor. But if we can stay healthy and improve each week, I like our chances, Shelton said. We have a good mix of size and speed, and as the kids start to click with our concepts, we're going to be competitive. Bront Longhorns looking to break through with playoff trip in 2022 by Paul Harris, published August 18th. Even with a declining enrollment over the last decade, Bront High School has continued to have success in nearly every sport. Football, however, has been an exception. The Longhorns struggled in their final years as an 11-man program, and they've failed to find their footing so far since dropping to the 6-man level in 2018. Second-year head coach Tel Rutledge is hopeful the upcoming season will be the one that turns things around. Bront returns all 6 starters from last season, and the Longhorns should also benefit from a drop into Class 1A Division 2, playing with schools that have a similar enrollment. We're feeling pretty optimistic about this year, Rutledge said. We didn't have the numbers to really compete with Division I schools, and this year we're on a more competitive level. We've got pretty much the same core that have been playing since they were freshmen. Bront was 2-8 last year with a 1-3 mark in district, though the Longhorns did defeat Coke County rival Robert Lee 38-16. Running back Jeff Jackson and tight end Tegan Menares will be the leaders on offense, and they'll also anchor the Longhorns' defensive line, Rutledge said. Jayton Galvin returns as quarterback. We ran a lot of spread last year, kind of out of necessity, because everybody we were playing was so much bigger than us. This year, we'll be moving more under center, Rutledge said. Other returners include running back Aiden Beck, linebacker Cole Knight, and wide receiver Parker Bearden. Bront hasn't had a winning season since 2012, when the Longhorns were nearing the end of a successful era in which they reached the playoffs 5 straight seasons and won back-to-back district titles in 2010 and 2011. Their last playoff appearance was in 2015. With Bront's move to District 13 1A Division 2, the Longhorns' postseason chances increased significantly, beginning with the fact that they left behind a district that produced the last 2 state champions in 1A Division 1, Sterling City in 2020 and Westbrook in 2021. Bront's road to the playoffs now goes through a 4-team district with number 14 ranked Lorraine, Blackwell, and Trent. The top 2 teams qualify for the postseason. Lorraine, which returns all of its starters from last year's 8-4 team, is the obvious favorite. Blackwell and Trent each won 4 games last year and return about half of their starters, which makes the race for the second playoff spot look like an open battle. I think we've got a pretty good shot of making the playoffs, Rutledge said. With our first round draw, I feel like if we get in the playoffs, I'm pretty confident we could win a playoff game. And those kinds of things haven't been done in Bront in a long time, and we're hoping to get those things accomplished and get this thing rolling. Bront opens its 2022 season Friday, August 26th at Zephyr. The Longhorns' home opener will be 2 weeks later on September 9th against Very Best. And now here's the column from Allison Watkins. Herbs can benefit your garden and butterflies. Published August 19th. This is most definitely a year that good plant selection matters. It's always important to choose plants that thrive in local conditions for a low-maintenance, earth-kind landscape. But during the extreme heat and drought, the native and well-adapted plants really stand out. Many herbs are Mediterranean plants and do well in the heat and are wonderful to have in the landscape because they have many advantages. They provide a delicious source of seasoning for meals. Many are good for butterflies. They are generally deer-resistant and are attractive perennials to have in the yard. So consider adding some flavorful herbs to the landscape this fall, as well as some butterfly nectar plants to help the monarchs as they migrate through around August. This will be a tough year for them, and every bit of assistance will make a difference in getting them through to Mexico for the winter. Nectar plants that adult butterflies like to visit include butterfly bush, butterfly weed, blue mist flower, lantana, salvia, and flame acanthus. Be conscientious and careful with pesticide use around both herbs and butterfly plants. People and butterflies will be consuming the plants, so avoid insecticides as much as possible or only use the properly labeled edible garden-safe product according to label directions if needed for herbs. In addition to nectar flowers, try to provide a water source for adult butterflies. If there is an existing wet spot, like where air conditioner condensate drains, that will do. If not, a shallow saucer of sand with water added to make it damp can help. Also, use drip irrigation instead of sprinklers as much as possible because spraying nozzles can wash the nectar out of the flowers. Some of the recommended herbs for the Concho Valley that can be planted in the fall include evergreens like sage, winter savory, rosemary, thyme, oregano, lavender, marjoram, and chives. Cool season annuals like parsley, cilantro, and semi-evergreen perennials like mint, catnip, catmint, lemon balm, Mexican mint marigold, and lemon verbena. Most herbs prefer full sun and well-drained soil. Incorporating compost can help loosen up soil and increase drainage. Some do well in poor soil, though, like lavender. It will thrive in rocky, lean soil, so don't add organic matter. Mints can handle more shade and poor drainage. Don't miss the annual Fall Landscaping Symposium offered by the Concho Valley Master Gardeners on Saturday, September 10th. For info and to register, visit https://txmg.org/Concho Valley. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.